to save the West, a leftist education. I was fascinated over the fact that your parents were liberal. And when you did decide to run for office, your mother campaigned for you, but your father didn't. And then all of a sudden, you headed all these Democratic organizations, and all of a sudden, you had an epiphany. What happened?
In terms of my why I moved
your evolution,
to be a conservative.
Yes.
Well, so back in the 1980s, my mum was a campaigner for the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. So she wanted to get American missiles out of Britain. And she was quite anti-American. She was probably one of the few Brits who talked about Caspar Weinberger, who was
Reagan's
defense secretary. Yeah. I knew about that when I was a child.
Wow.
But as I grew up, I started questioning what was happening. And I saw that it was the strength of Thatcher and Reagan that brought down the Soviet Union. It wasn't by giving in to them. It wasn't by getting rid of our weapons. It was actually the strength that delivered. So I watched what my parents said, but I thought for myself about what was actually happening. And that's why I got interested in politics in the first place. And then it was a while before I became a conservative because I didn't really want to admit it, because a lot of my parents' friends were left-wing. Everyone I knew was left-wing. You know, we lived in a city of Leeds. It was all very liberal. And admitting you were a conservative was like saying you had two heads.
But early on, your parents spent time in Warsaw, and that had a profound impact on them.
Well, they had a... They thought communism wasn't necessarily a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad went... I mean, I was only two when we went to Warsaw, but my... When they had to stand in queues to get basic food, and when they couldn't afford very much on the salary, they then had second thoughts about communism. So I think being in Warsaw in the 1970s put them off.
There's one thing that comes across in your book, 10 Years to Save the West, is that there could be no compromise when it comes to returning to conservative values. Explain that.
Well, what I've seen happen is I do have very strongly held conservative values, and because I was brought up in the left, I had to think for myself, and I thought, what is the right thing? And what are the principles I believe in? And I believe in freedom. I believe in the nation state. I believe that Britain is a great country and can become even better. And those are the things that I hold very dear. And when I see conservatives who kowtow to the left, I think, well, why are you even in the Conservative Party? So, for example, on environmentalism, you know, saying that we need these net zero regulations and that we won't even think about what it's going to cost ordinary people. I think we've been pushed into that by left-wing environmental campaigners or the whole transgender agenda. You know, we've had people in the Conservative Party saying trans women are women. Well, they're clearly not. And so what I think it is that conservatives have been scared to really say what they think, because the left have been so virulent and so pushy, and they've tried to sort of make it socially unacceptable to be a conservative. So that's why I'm saying that we need to stand up to those people.
You know, you said, and I'm going back to your book, is that we need to focus on long-term future of the Conservative Party. You said we have to know what we believe in and hold our representatives accountable for their actions. That's something that you just spoke to. But you go on to say is that we need to bring power back to the people and stop thinking that big government and the deep state are our friends.
Yeah, there are too many conservatives who believe that if only they get into a ministerial job, they will be able to change the people, that they will somehow be able to get their policies done. And what I'm saying to conservatives is I tried. I tried for 10 years. I was in lots of different government departments, education, justice, environment, the treasury.
Foreign secretary.
I even got into number 10 Downing Street. And what I'm saying is with the current system we have, with the power that unelected bureaucrats have and the agencies have, it is not possible to deliver Conservative policies until we actually change the system and the people in those jobs.
But let me stop you, because what is fascinating, when you speak of the deep state, you're speaking of something totally different from here. Because what you're saying, that there's very little you could change the bureaucracy that you inherited in all the positions that you're in. And through a lot of these organizations where very few people make the decisions for many, and it's hard to change that process no matter who you are.
So in America, the president can appoint 3,000 senior people in the government. In Britain, the prime minister only gets to appoint 100 people.
Wow.
And those people aren't even senior people. They're advisors. They're not in the chain of command. So all of the key people in our bureaucracy are permanent civil servants, permanent officials. And I think in the past it's worked better than it does now. But what I think we're seeing is the bureaucracy is becoming increasingly politicized, and we've got activists in our bureaucracy now, people who are environmental zealots or people who are
climate change zealots,
mm-hmm. or they're obsessed with gender ideology, or they're DEI, or in the Home Office, which is our department that deals with immigration, they hate the idea of deporting illegal immigrants, and they've actually joined the Home Office to stop illegal immigrants being deported. I mean, this is the kind of people we now have operating in our bureaucracy.
So you go on to say institutions need to be held accountable for their action, including, which is something you're very familiar with, big banking, the World Health Organizations, because you feel they hurt millions of people, were devastated during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Absolutely, and I feel that the World Health Organization in particular was heavily under the influence of China. And this is what we've seen in many of these big multilateral organizations like the United Nations as well. I believe the organizations we can trust are the ones that have free democracies in them. So NATO, for example, I think is an effective organization. But how on earth can we trust a Security Council when two of the members are China and Russia? These are the countries that are seeking to do us harm. So I think we need to be realistic about who is actually running these organizations and whether they're helping the West or actually undermining us.
You talk a lot about restoring conservative leadership in the West and combining forces with our goals and our conservative allies. But one of the things you talk a lot about, and I want you to explain in more detail, you said we need to restore the nation state.
We do. So Brexit was part of restoring the nation state. That is why people in Britain voted for Brexit. They didn't want to be told what to do by unelected EU bureaucrats. The problem is they're now being told what to do by unelected British bureaucrats, and they don't like that very much either. But the EU is a body like that. But what we're now finding, and Britain is part of the European Convention of Human Rights, is we're now being told what to do by judges in Strasbourg. So even though we've left the European Union, we are still subject to the controls of other international bodies. And the nation state is what people feel part of. People feel they're British. They don't feel they're part of the ECHR. They don't feel they're part of the United Nations. They feel British. And that is what we need to restore.
You go on to say appeasing our enemies never work. You say that we need to assert the virtues of the free world and crack down on China, Russia, and other enemies.
That's right. I mean, we've just seen Janet Yellen in China again.
Again.
We've seen American corporations kowtowing to President Xi. These people are not our friends. And If you go back to what happened in the Cold War, President Reagan called out the Soviet Union as the evil empire. When are we going to see President Biden call out China in those terms?
What are your thoughts? I know the headlines since you've been in the United States on your tour referring to the president as ignorant. Now, some people may take that as offensive, but I, as a broadcast owner and host, want to know what you think, what is ignorant about, because I know you're talking about his policies. Policies that absolutely not don't work and can prove to be futile.
And what I've seen, and I served in the British cabinet under both President Trump and President Biden, so I've seen what the difference looks like. Mm-hmm. And the world does not fear President Biden. China, Russia, and Iran have increased in their belligerence since, for example, in Iran, the sanctions were taken off. The sanctions were taken off Iran. Biden suggested that we could renegotiate the nuclear deal with Iran. And what have we seen happening? We've seen an increasingly aggressive Iran. We saw the appalling attacks on Israel, the recent failed attacks over the last weekend. And that is essentially an appeasement strategy. It's an appeasement strategy if you don't show strength to the aggressor. Instead, you try and do deals with them. And it's not just the United States. I think Europe has not spent enough on defence, you know, by a significant amount. I mean, most European countries aren't even spending the 2% NATO requirement. You know, back in the Cold War, we were spending 4 or 5% of our GDP on defence. And I think we've all been hugely complacent about the level of threat we face. And the only thing these authoritarian dictators understand is strength. That is the only thing they understand. And any time we try and cut a deal or, you know, take off sanctions or try and blame Israel for what's happened. I mean, I get very frustrated when I hear that Israel should be restrained in what they're doing. You know, they are facing an existential threat.
The point about, and I want to continue with Israel, was about the taxes with President Biden.
Yeah.
Give us your assessment of the burgeoning conflict. You touched on it. Between Israel and Iran, and what you think needs to happen?
What I think needs to happen is we need to 100% back Israel. And I worry about statements saying that Israel should hold back or they should show restraint. The fact is that Iran is threatening their very existence as a nation.
But should
and
they,
we should back them wholeheartedly.
But should they respond to Iran's onslaught of over 500 missiles? Some mistrust, which even flew over the holy city of Jerusalem and a place for all three of the Abrahamic faiths, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. How far should they go? Should they be measured? Considering,
I mean, I'm not going to advise Israel on their military strategy. You know, they're in a much better position to say than me exactly how they should respond. But what I would observe is that the United States should not be holding them back in their response. We should not be saying, you know, you've had it okay, we managed to deal with that onslaught. Because what we know is that when authoritarian regimes feel that there isn't a response, or, and this was, you know, what happened with Obama and the red line in Syria, when they feel there isn't a response, they then push further. They then push further. So this is why I'm saying that Israel should be free to pursue the strategy they need to pursue in order to protect themselves against Iran.
You know, in your book, on page 109, chapter 7, Liberty, Equality, and Wokery, you say the United Kingdom and the United States share a unique heritage of freedom. We are exceptional, but you feel it is threatened.
I do. I feel that those values that we believe in, that are deeply embedded right from Magna Carta to the Bill of Rights to the American Constitution. I feel those values are being undermined. They're being undermined in our schools. They're being undermined in our universities. The very idea of truth and the Enlightenment and the importance of truth is being undermined today by leftists who don't believe in any of that stuff. They don't believe in the idea that our way of life is the right way of life and actually is delivered huge opportunity and prosperity for millions and millions of people.
Why do you believe the world is at war?
I believe the world is at war because the West was complacent. You know, we were complacent after the end of the Cold War. We kind of thought freedom's won, free enterprise has won, America, all of its allies, we've been successful, our way of life has been proven right. And we allowed the Putin regime to develop. You know, do you remember Putin was even invited to the G8 at one point?
While he was carrying on.
Exactly.
In Ukraine.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. We allowed China to get rich and powerful. Back in the 1990s, the Chinese economy was only a tenth the size of the American economy. It's now purchasing power parity with America because we let China into the WTO. We didn't insist they followed the same rules that countries like America and Britain have to follow. And on the subject of Iran, again, we allowed them to get away and get away with building up this capacity to have a nuclear weapon. So it's been our complacency that has meant that these evil regimes have felt empowered. They felt empowered to do what they are now doing.
You know, you spoke about Iran. What preventative steps should be taken to prevent Iran from becoming a nuclear nation? Our intelligence communities note that they're likely at 60% with their uranium enrichment program.
Well, we need to get much tougher. We've got to abandon all this idea that there will be some kind of nuclear deal with Iran. I support the approach President Trump took when he was last in office of the tough sanctions on Iran. And we need to also be tougher on China, who are bypassing a lot of the Iranian sanctions. I mean, these regimes are working together. You know, we saw Hamas in Moscow. We've seen the Chinese and North Koreans supplying to Russia. And what they're doing is they're backing each other up. So we need to make it clear to China that if you want trade with the West, you can't be backing up the idea of Iran getting a nuclear weapon.
No, you talk in your book, in chapter 4, which is another fascinating chapter, Rough Justice. You say there is going to be some in-fight turbulence. That was the warning I gave to Theresa May once I had
There certainly was. I got roundly trounced in the British press after I did what I did. So
but yes. It was principle.
Yeah.
It was principle.
Because I don't see the point, Armstrong, of taking on a government job if you're not going to do something. If you're just going to go along with what the unelected bureaucrats think, what's the point of you being there if you're just a figurehead? I wanted to change things. That's why I went into politics, because I want to see a justice system that works. I wanted to deal with the problems in prison. I want the justice system to be accountable to Parliament, which I'm afraid it isn't as much as it used to be.
But you know, even though your being prime minister was short-lived, you remain in Parliament.
Yes.
Which tells you it's not about ego for you.
No.
You want to serve and make a difference.
I do. And in Britain, Parliament is the absolutely crucial crucible of where things happen. You know, I want to persuade as many of my colleagues as possible that how big the system changes need to be in Britain so we can make the changes. And the only place I can do that from is Parliament.
You know, in a recent interview, you endorsed former President Donald Trump because you said the world needs a strong America. You went on to say that our opponents feared when Donald Trump was in office more than President Biden. What made you draw that conclusion? And you think other world leaders agree and won't say it publicly?
Well, I have seen for myself the difference that having Donald Trump in the White House and having President Biden in the White House has made. I've seen that difference. You know, we've seen what's happened in Ukraine, with Israel and Iran, with China, and the approach has not been as tough.
Tell us.
The approach has not been as tough.
Let us see the difference. Show us the difference. Something simple that people can relate to.
Well, the Iranian sanctions. The Iranian sanctions were taken off. The line on China has got softer. You know, we didn't see all of these delegations of business people to China under President Trump. You know, he put tough restrictions on trade on China. Now, I personally didn't like some of the other restrictions he did, including on Britain. I was not happy about that. But on China, he sent a very clear message. And I think some people criticise Trump's rhetoric, but I think it got the message across to those leaders of those regimes that if they overstepped the mark, they didn't know what Trump would do.
Fear.
He was unpredictable.
Yes.
Unfortunately, it's all too predictable what the response of the Biden administration will be to any action by one of those regimes.
What is it that we don't talk about enough that is looming, the media, people with influence, that scares you?
I'm scared by quite a lot of things at the moment. I think the prospect of war is very serious and very real, and we are still not doing enough on defence, and we are not doing enough to build up our defences. But I think the number one thing I'm worried about is the level of debt we're getting to in the West and whether there is some kind of economic crisis. Because we've been spending money like there's no tomorrow. Taxes have gone up, which is making our economies more lethargic, particularly in Europe, less so in America. Although I don't think America's as dynamic as it could be. I think there needs to be more deregulation, more use of oil and gas in America, more fracking. But that's the thing that worries me most, is the lack of economic growth and the fact that our economies are shrinking relative to the whole world. And what we're seeing is China's economy is growing relative to the world. And ultimately, money talks.
Money talks.
You know, that's where, you know, where does power ultimately come from? It comes from economic power.
You know, BRICS, Iran, Ethiopia, South Africa, China, Russia, just passed a resolution condemning Israel without mentioning the rockets that were propelled upon them during that raid in the last few days. I mean, should we take BRICS seriously?
Well, no.
Given that an anemic response?
Well, no, and those are a bunch of countries with very different objectives from each other. But we should absolutely take China seriously. And we should be much more strategic as the West in how we deal with China. What's going on at the moment is treasuries in many countries are prioritizing short-term financial gain over our long-term security. So that's what worries me. I don't really worry about what statements these countries make. I talk in my book about UN resolutions and how there's constant pressure for anti-Israel resolutions at the United Nations. And there's a lot of, I'm afraid, anti-Semitism going on. There are a lot of countries who are antagonistic towards Israel. But I do think that it's what we do that matters as much as resolutions that are passed at the UN.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode.